Hello and welcome to Blah Blah Comics, Blah Blah Curse Words. I'm Derek.
I'm Colby.
And we talk comics sometimes.
Yes, sometimes in a fashion about teams and people we like.
On those teams.
Yes.
Yes, this is our special top 10 teams podcast. We've been talking about doing something like this for a while, kind of internally, and decided that today would be the day. We wanted to talk about our favorite teams in superhero and maybe not necessarily superhero comics.
Yes. And once again, keyword here is our favorite, because these will by no means are these the definitive best teams, the ones that we think are the most important to comic readers, but they're the ones we like the most. So if you don't like them, I don't really care. But thank
you. It also means you can probably tell who my top five are just by knowing me, but that's okay.
Yeah. You could probably be similar here, but you know what? We, like I said earlier, we don't have a ton of time, but let's do this quick and efficiently and talk about all this cool stuff, because I want to make sure we get this
really quick.
I had two teams that didn't make my list. My runners-up, I'll just say them really quickly, the Injustice League and the Rogues.
Nice. Yeah, I actually didn't put any villain teams on mine. I didn't really think about that. But yeah, both of those are fantastic. I would have to actually add the Masters of Evil to that list.
Okay.
And the Wrecking Crew. I love the Wrecking Crew. They are the... they are the jobbers of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, I didn't think about villains much team either. I'm going to throw Four Horsemen of Apocalypse and Brotherhood of Evil up there too.
Cool, and, okay.
There we go. There's a bunch of people that didn't make the list.
My other villain team that did not make the list, I got to give props to the Brotherhood of Dada.
Ah, yes, that's a good one. There'll be similar teams on my list from them.
Of course. But my number 10, and I don't have a lot to say about them other than I adore the concept and I wish people would do more with them. My number 10 is the Metal Men.
Well, there's been rumors forever that movie's coming out.
Yeah, and so many people have done so many different things with them. The problem is, I think a lot of people try to Doom Patrol the Metal Men.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think it works because the Metal Men are too joyously campy a project for that kind of doom and gloom and, you know, is Dr. Magnus secretly evil and all of that to really stick. Yeah. They're too goofy. And if you just played them straight, I think you would actually get a lot more out of them as characters. Just play the campiness with a straight face. I mean, Batman Brave and the Bold kind of proved that that approach can work. And I think that is the approach you need to take with the Metal Men to really make them take off. But I love the concept. Liquid, or not necessarily Liquid, but robots built of a certain kind of metal with chips in their brains to make them kind of sentient. And Doc Magnus is just this crazy inventor guy who decided, I'm going to make a superhero team. And he did, and it is glorious. So yeah, that's my number 10.
Very good choice. My number 10, it is a team, but it's more of an organization. It almost made my runner-up list because it's not entirely a team, but I said, screw it, I'll put it on there. I'm putting the entire Mind Management on number 10.
Very nice.
Which, once again, I talk about Mind Management all the time. It's basically a organization of people with extraordinary abilities, normally of the psychic variety, almost always psychic variety, but a psychic variety, and people that are behind the scenes keeping people safe, or in some cases not so safe.
Yeah, I admit, I only read the first not even quite trades worth of Mind Management. It was a solid series. I wish I'd stuck with it. I'll probably end up picking up on Comixology sometime because it is really, really fantastic. Excellent and unique choice for your number 10.
Thank you, thank you.
My number 9 is much more straightforward, I think, and mostly due to about 4 creators. My number 9 is The Authority.
They were very close to being on my list. Very, very, very close.
Yeah, between Warren Ellis and Brian Hitch and Mark Miller and Frank Quitely, that was the superhero comic to beat for about a 4 or 5 year stretch there at the late 90s, early 2000s. They redefined comics for better or worse. The idea of widescreen comics took place under their run. The idea of the JLA without a conscience came to the fore. It was a millstone, a milestone in comics publishing when The Authority hit the scene. And I think while those comics haven't aged as well as one would hope, I think they are they're a strong release, and I still deeply enjoy them.
Well, I'm glad that's your number 9, or number 10, because my number 9 is The Elite.
Ha 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 ha.
Yeah, which I love. I love Manchester Black to death. And, yeah, it's basically DC's answer to The Authority. And for anyone who's really wondering what happened to Truth, Justice, and the American Way, one of the, in my opinion, one of the greatest single-issue comics ever, one of my favorite comics ever, showing what happens when a team like The Authority or The Elite go too far and what happens when they're trying to convince someone like Superman to join their ranks.
Right.
But The Elite, for also just being very similar to The Authority, but also remaining their own, having their own voice, even though they were a clear analogy for them at the time.
Absolutely, and it was really, Joe Kelly has an incredible satiric ability to take the piss out of certain ideas and concepts, and I think The Elite is an incredibly sharp example of his talent. For parody, the Hat was always my favorite character from them, and I wish they'd done more with him because that was he was fun.
I'm surprised they haven't done more with him, especially with the DCU and all that stuff recently.
Mm-hmm.
But people forget how popular they were at one point. Not only justifying their own pop-ins in Justice League, but also justifying their own comic book Justice League Elite for a while. They had their time and place, and I think they should come back. There's Amazing Superman vs. the Elite, one of my favorite DC animated movies. There's a lot of good material out there for him. I would say if you want to go check him out, there's not a lot of that team, so you could definitely find everything of that team pretty easily.
Yeah, there's probably 2, maybe 3 trades worth.
Yeah, it's not a ton. Like I said, 2 or 3 trades plus what happened, Truth, Justice, American Way. And
I think they may have actually squeezed that into the first Justice League Elite trade. I'm not positive on that, though. Don't quote me.
I wouldn't be surprised. But yeah, so there is my number 9.
Oh, awesome. That is so you, too. And I mean that as a compliment.
Thank you.
That is very much a you choice. Number 8 for me is, again, a very, very classic idea. Very specifically looking at the Wolfman Perez Teen Titans, but I would also put a nod towards the Mike McCone, Jeff Johns relaunch of the title in the early 2000s as well. Pulling together such stalwart classics as Robin, Kid Flash, and Changeling Reed Beast Boy, bringing in characters like Raven, Cyborg, and Starfire, and basically challenging the X-Men's throne for a while. Just really fun but surprisingly adult takes on teenage characters, and finally, once and for all, putting a stake in the idea that a sidekick is nothing without the hero. I think a lot of characters and a lot of characterization in comics for younger characters owes a debt to the Teen Titans. Even going all the way back to Bob Haney's batshit insane, try to talk like the kids, slaying Teen Titans of the day. Those comics are nuts, but you know, you can't dismiss them. It's an endearing and enduring concept.
Aww. Plus they had that cool, weird crossover. Probably the 90s, I can't remember exactly, but it seems like a 90s saying that Teen Titans and X-Men.
That was in the 80s.
Was that in the 80s?
No, it was totally in the 80s, yeah.
Okay.
And it was definitely out of continuity because it was the Dark Phoenix and Darkseid like meeting and deciding to join forces, which is kind of phenomenal.
Yeah. Very nice choice. So yeah, I completely agree with that too. My number 8, it would have been higher, but my favorite incarnation of this team has never actually been really in the comics, but they're mentioned in the comics, and the incarnation in the comics is great. My number 8 is the Killjoys from Danger Days, The True Lives of the Fabulous Killjoys.
Wonderful.
Which, if you guys don't know, based on the My Chemical Romance album of the same name, it's a team of people in outside of Battery City. Think Akira meets a lot of acid and a lot of crazy. And I think Akira meets the Sex Pistols. Essentially, is a lot of what the Killjoys are. This ragtag group of people, of course, in the album being the 4 main members of the band. If I can remember all, Party Poison, Jetstar, Fun Ghoul, or Cool Ghoul. Oh, God. I'm missing somebody. God damn it. Hold on once. I'm going to hate myself for this.
That's okay.
No,
that's
it's okay. Not. It's not okay. Cobra Kid.
Cobra Kid.
Anyway, and then the comics picking up spoiler after they die, and it's a typical tale of this group of heroes that were trying to do the right thing, and this group of followers that have taken their word and is somewhat leading the resistance in the same way, but of course it's also led by people that don't always have the greatest intentions and kind of dislike the attention they get, not so much the good intentions that the original Killjoys had. So I would put the main core group of the Killjoys in there, but they weren't really in the comics, so I'm going to just have to say Killjoys in general.
You know, if we let Lance put the Daredevil TV show as one of his favorite Daredevil stories, I think it's fair for you to put the original Killjoys as one of your favorite teams. I'm totally okay with that.
I'll count them. They're in the comics, so I'll count it. But their costumes are in the comics, really.
Well, my number 7 is probably going to be much, much, much higher on your list. But unfortunately, just the way my list shook out, ended up being a little lower than I would have thought on mine. My number 7 is the Doom Patrol.
Yeah, they are going to be higher, I will say that.
Yeah. Robot Man, the Negative Guy, his name is not Mr. Negative, it's like Negative Man?
Yeah, Negative Man.
Thank you. I knew it was something like that. Elastigirl. Really the classic lineup, because what was so great about Morrison's run was he took the classic lineup and did so much more with them, but he also did it truly within the spirit of what Kaniger, and I'm so ashamed I can't remember the artist's name, but what they did with their original Doom Patrol strip. Again, that's a book that we haven't seen a lot of people do justice to, I feel, because I think the first person to really do anything with it after Kaniger was Morrison.
Yeah.
And then, to a certain extent, Keith Giffen in the early 2000s definitely played with some of those concepts. And I know Geoff Johns, bless his heart, tried to get the Doom Patrol right, but I feel like he missed the mark. And I feel like it's such an easy title to miss the mark for,
yeah,
because it is a strange and different and purposefully awkward and off-putting book. And if you can't nail that very thin line of purposefully off-putting yet still tremendously engaging, you're just not getting Doom Patrol right. And I mean, even as a writer myself, I don't feel like I could nail that line, and I always applaud those who do, which is one of the reasons, and I know we're supposed to be trying to keep this one kind of evergreen. As of the recording of this podcast, we have not yet seen Gerard Way's Doom Patrol release yet, but that's one of the things that has me so excited about it, is I feel like after finally having read Umbrella Academy, Way definitely knows how to play with the off-putting as enticing in a way that a lot of writers don't.
Yeah, it's something, I mean, of course, he will pop up on mine a few times, but there's several reasons why I'm excited for the Way one, but that, beyond my own fanboy of his other works, it's mostly just because he is a writer who knows how to handle that thin line that Morrison can with those of the awkward and strange and not letting it become too gimmicky or over the top just for the sake of gimmicky and over the top.
Right, exactly. So, and that is why way down at number 7, I hate to admit, is the Doom Patrol. I wish there had been more great things done with him. But even with the very little truly great Doom Patrol comics, I feel they are one of the truly great superhero teams.
Very nice. Let's see, what number? This is my number 7?
You're number 7.
That's right. My number 7, also one that shouldn't shock anybody, a newer team, but a team that may not have got the best reviews, but I love and really had a blast with, Red Hood and the Outlaws.
That is a bit surprising, but knowing you, it totally does make sense.
A story that, once again, Red Hood has someone, since Under the Red Hood, he's been handled a million different ways, sometimes really cool, sometimes really boring. But I felt this one was a fun take on the character of him hooking up with two other people that are very damaged in their own way, especially Arsenal, and pairing Starfire with him, with a lot of people, of course, didn't like the New 52 version of her at first. But putting her in a light that made sense for her to be in that group, and just putting them in those crazy, crazy comic adventures that we love comics for, sending them to space, in another dimension, sending them to this, having memory loss, having age-old enemies pop back up. Just very typical comic stuff, but done in a way that was just so fun, and it was what that team, I think, needed. And, yeah, I had a blast with it. If anyone wants to, I think Volume 2, The Starfire, it's a really, really fun run about them going to help Starfire on her home planet overtake these people that are trying to take it over. And it's simple and fun.
the next time that comes up on Comixology, I will buy it because there are aspects of Red Hood and the Outlaws that I've seen that I think would be very enjoyable. If that's the story you recommend, that's the story
I would read. That would be the one that is the go-to volume 2 of the Starfire. It's by far the best, in my opinion.
Awesome. Well, I'll definitely be picking that up. My number 6 is the Warren Ellisiest Warren Ellis you can probably get outside of Transmetropolitan. My number 6 is Planetary.
Oh, that's a good one.
There is something delightful about seeing Warren Ellis as author insert character Elijah Snow with a piss take on Wonder Woman and a perpetual stoner in the drummer, looking at the detritus of the last century of pop culture and distilling it for meaning. Planetary is an important book, I think, especially of its time, but even today, 15 years later, maybe a little bit shorter than that, but it was supposed to be a book about 2000 and 2001 and the promise of a new century, looking back through the pop culture of the past. It means something. There's something about that book that is, like I said, it's important. It's something. It gives us a lens to view what we've done and what we're capable of, and to do it through those particular three characters. Like I say, it's an utter delight, and yeah, it's a book that affected me pretty profoundly. It's unfortunately truncated. It was one of the biggest sufferers of Warren Ellis' hard drive crash is that he lost the last few issues of Planetary and had to rewrite them, which is why they were so late. Yeah. But even taking that into account, casting the Fantastic Four as the villains who ended up keeping culture the same, while themselves being wildly different and inventive and new, that alone is an idea that should, you know, break your brain to some extent. And it's not the only, nor is it the most exciting idea that Warren Ellis plays with in that series. And like I say, the fact that he basically introduced himself into the comics world as a character through which to view this world and these events is nothing short of spectacular. So yeah, again, surprisingly low on the list considering how much I loved about it. Number 6 is Planetary. The only reason it's that low is that my 1 through 5 are incredibly traditional picks because I am at heart a very traditional fanboy nerd.
That's fair. Planetary, it's such a good reading. I know it was for a long time. I don't know if it still is, but for a long time, Planetary issue 1 was free on Comixology.
That's true. It was for a very long time.
I think maybe still. If not, that's a one I would 100% recommend picking up. It's a fun read for me. And I know they just released an omnibus not too long ago, too.
Yeah, they did. And they put the Absolutes back into print. Also, there was they did a number of quote-unquote crossovers. The best one by far is Planetary Batman Night on Earth. Going through the looking at the Crisis on Infinite Earth's story through the eyes of Planetary is hilarious. And then you also get the roulette wheel of different alternate world Batmans through the eyes of Warren Ellis and John Cassaday, which I didn't mention at all in my ravings about Planetary, but John Cassaday brought so much to that book. A very dynamic, realistic, but action-heavy, think an even more hyper-competent Brian Hitch, and you've got something along the lines of what you'd see from Prime Cassaday, and you have a form for intense and amazing success. Everything about that book is awesome. There's less than 25 issues. I can't remember if it's 22 or 24, but there's less than 25 issues total of the main Planetary story, plus Planetary Batman Night on Earth. There's an Authority crossover and a JLA crossover. They're fine. They're worth reading, but if you want the Planetary story, it's right there at your fingertips, and every bit of it is awesome.
Nice. Well, for my next one, it's probably actually the only traditional one on mine, but I had to put it on there because you have to. It's the Justice League Main 7.
Yeah, they're actually on mine too.
Because you can't beat them. Yes, people, I know nowadays the Avengers are huge, and I like the Avengers, but for your money, for your bang for your buck, just the main Justice League were always the the all-star team of who's who. There was no secondary, like, B-team characters. There was no these small people. They were all very important, all came from very different types of comics, and combined actually felt like they were, if any problem needed the Justice League, it feels very important, actually. It doesn't feel like just another story, and when it's done properly.
Right. I'll have a little bit more trenchant things to say about Justice League a little bit further along this list, but all of that is absolutely right.
Yes, so the Justice League are on there, of course.
Of course. My number five, and this is where it starts getting, well, no shit, you're you, with my list. My number five is the Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah, I thought they'd be on there.
There's something endlessly optimistic about quite literally a Legion, often a team with more than 20 members at a time, of kids who look back on more or less the comic books of the past and take inspiration from those heroes, specifically Superboy, and decide that they too want to do good and they too want to do right. But even more than that, the Legion of Superheroes is probably the best sci-fi comic you'll ever read, especially the first couple hundred issues, the ones that were published during the 60s and 70s, because they literally throw out 100 big ideas an issue just because it's whatever they need to get to move the plot along, you know? You need somebody to have ice powers? Well, they come from a planet where everybody has ice powers. You need somebody to lose an arm? Well, there's a giant space whale, and you call the story the Moby Dick of space. Characters die. Characters come back to life. Characters change powers. It was the book where the illusion of change didn't exist because you could literally do whatever you wanted. There was no real continuity except the continuity of the book itself. It was set, you know, 1,000 years in the future. You could do whatever you wanted, and most writers and artists absolutely did. The romance, the soap opera, the action, the adventure, the imagination. It's all there. And I think that's what really draws me to the Legion more than anything else. The sheer amount of can't give a fuck, lack of cynicism, imagination in the pages of those comics really shines through. And it brightens my day, and it brightens my feelings about our future. If comics writers of the 1960s and 70s could imagine such a bright future, maybe I can too.
Aw, that's sweet. I'm going from sweet to kind of heartbreaking. My next one is Rick Remender's Uncanny X-Force.
Nice. Yeah, I figured that one was going to be on yours too.
For one, once again, I will never stop harping on, for one, just how good that run is, but also the heartbreaking story of Dark Angel. It's truly heartbreaking. And the hardest part about the story is, even when we get Angel back, his memory is gone.
Right.
He is gone, and reverted back to a very simple state, and Psylocke never gets him back.
Right.
That's the most heartbreaking thing, even to this day in comics. He's not him anymore. A lot more has happened, but that was the hardest thing for me, is that seeing the Psylocke story with her, and seeing him, and seeing them devolve into these just monsters, and then when the problem is fixed, it's still not fixed, which is something that doesn't happen in comics very often.
It's true. It's definitely a story with a beginning, middle, and end, and I think it is handled exceptionally well for the 35 or so issues that story is allowed to take place. And that's not something you get oftentimes in a medium that is stuck in a perpetual second act. And I think you're absolutely right. Uncanny X-Force was an astonishing book.
I just realized, oddly enough, it literally begins with introducing the character Genesis. You have Angel's betrayal, you have Wolverine's son betrayal, you have a story arc we won't mention that wasn't that great, but besides with Otherworld,
you have a story arc that you desperately need to have read 20 years ago Excalibur comics to understand.
And have a very, very specific taste in art to like.
Yeah, which is funny because it's Asad Ribic. It's the same guy doing Secret Wars. It was an art style that did not work for.
We've mentioned this, it just all feels like a dream for some reason. Mm-hmm. And that hurts it so bad.
Yeah.
But instead of that, focus on the good. Uncanny X-Force, the majority of it, you cannot go wrong with.
Yeah. My number four, you've already brought it up, and again, kind of surprising, it's down here at number four, but this is our favorites list, not our best list, and yeah. Unfortunately, these are my fourth favorite, is the Big 7 JLA.
Yeah.
And it's basically what you said, and to slightly expound upon that, the JLA comics, starting with Grant Morrison and ending with Joe Kelly, 90-some-odd issues, every single goddamn issue brought the concepts. It brought the explosions. It brought the ideas that it would take these superheroes to defeat. Yeah. You know, I've read a couple of hundred, probably closer to 300 or 400 Avengers issues, and you'd be surprised how many of them are the Avengers dealing with very, very Earth-level threats. I mean, sure, we've got the Kree-Skrull War. Sure, we've got Secret Invasion. But so many of them are dealing with government bureaucracy or some kind of giant stupid robot or, you know, honestly, piddly shit in comparison. Yeah. Whereas, and, you know, I'm sure you could say the same thing about 90% of the pre-Grant Morrison Justice League, but Grant Morrison took the concept of these seven characters and gave them a reason to get together. There's got to be a reason you need more than Superman to take care of a problem. And Grant Morrison illustrated that concept beautifully, and everybody who picked up the baton afterwards just kept that going for such an incredible run. I mean, there's 8 solid 12 to 14 issue collection trade paperbacks out there of nothing but balls out superhero entertainment with these characters, and that's not nothing. That's an astonishing run of perfection, basically. I cannot, if I had to recommend a single book from any of these collections, I would say the Grant Morrison Justice League stuff, because that is the best and most perfect take on superhero comics as a concept. And if this were a best of list, that would be my number one. But since it's a favorite, it's down here at number four. But yeah, the Big 7 JLA.
No, I completely agree. And the best part about that is every single Barnes & Noble I have ever gone to has had almost an entire run to buy. So exactly. If anyone wants to pick it up, I think they range from $15 to $30 a volume, but they're worth it, all of them, I would say. It's not a bad volume there.
Yeah, I want to say they average about $24.99, and you're getting, like I say, 12 to 14 issues a volume of comics, so you're getting a lot of phenomenal comics for your buck right there.
I mean, crap, Rock of Ages alone is incredible. Even like World War III and a few of that stuff is like...
I dig it all. There's not a single bad Grant Morrison Justice League issue in my mind. And I'll fight somebody on that. Yeah. It's perfect.
Well, speaking of perfect and stuff, I have always thought it's perfect. We're in, like I said, the top ones that are kind of obvious. Probably. This is my favorite superhero big two DC Marvel, like DC Marvel proper, not Vertigo team. It's a team made up of not heroes, not villains, people in between. The Secret Six, and of course.
Nice.
High on my list. Gail Simone's Secret Six run. Especially, it's back now, and it's still good, but it's hard to tell where it's going. So I'm mainly focused on the pre-New 52 stuff. It is such an amazing run from the Villains United stuff up until the very giant last fight. We talked before, there are so many good issues from the Cal tie-in issue is amazing.
Yeah, Battle for the Cal is the single best issue of that book for me.
You have the Western issue, which is amazing. You have a few... you just have some incredible stuff. But like I said, it brought these characters that no one really cared about. From Catman, Ragdoll, even Bane and Scandal Savage and people like that. Which, yeah, they've had stuff. They've been here and there before. Yeah, they've been done some cool stuff before. But they were all just kind of characters that never really were evolved past a certain point. And Gail Simone took characters like Catman and Bane and made them, A, relatable, and two, fully fleshed out characters. You knew their intentions. You knew their backstory. It changed Bane entirely. It changed Catman entirely. You saw this redemption arc. You learned more about them. Even Deadshot, a character that's been around forever, it added a lot to that character and to who he was. And it's a story that... it's one of those comics I think later on, when the kind of next wave of writers takes over, I think more and more people will be influenced by that series.
Yeah, definitely.
And also, Gail Simone has been on the map for a while now, but I think it's a series that kind of just cemented her as being, yeah, she can take
She can take almost any character, almost not quite to the Grant Morrison level, but she can take almost any character that you think is unimportant and add meaning to that character's existence.
Absolutely, yeah. Her, you're absolutely right. She proved her bona fides on that book.
Yes, and continued on. For those who don't know, Super Six, I would definitely say read Batgirl if past that if you want to continue the story, just because there are some pop-ins from Secret Six characters in that series too.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, so Secret Six.
Wonderful choice. And again, we're kind of in the "of course they are" section of ours. So once again, of course, my number three was almost my number two, but then you clarified that I was allowed to make my number two my number two. So my number three would be the Fantastic Four.
Yep.
Yeah, and honestly, it's the classic lineup, and even more than that, it's the Lee Kirby run. I had the great pleasure to reread the Stan Lee Jack Kirby Fantastic Four issues over the course of 2014 for a readers club that I'm doing with another podcast that I really enjoy listening to. I've mentioned it on here all the time. It's Wait What. They do a once-a-month episode called The Baxter Building where they read and review a certain bulk of Fantastic Four comics, and they just happened to do the entire Lee Kirby run over the course of 2014. And it really did remind me and resonate with me what I love about these characters. And again, going back to what I was saying about the Legion of Superheroes, it's the imagination. Just so much creativity, stark, unfettered creativity on display issue by issue. Kirby drawing his heart out, coming up with ideas, and just leaving them. And he had so many ideas he could afford to just literally shit some out, throw them on a page, and maybe play with them later, maybe not. And watching Lee almost scurry to try to keep up and make sense of some of the occasionally contradictory, occasionally contrasting concepts and ideas and play. At their best together, Lee and Kirby were a powerhouse that could not be beat. And at their worst, there is still something to the mess that ends up coming out of Lee misunderstanding Kirby or Kirby not conveying what he wanted to do to Lee or Lee Reed telling Kirby or thing Kirby, you know, you're doing it wrong off panel. Because Kirby didn't bother to draw Reed in and is trying to say something else entirely, so Reed has to shout things off panel. There's magic there. And as much as I kind of talked about the Fantastic Four ruining everything in the eyes of Warren Ellis over in Planetary, it doesn't take away from the fact that there was genuinely something new and unique and special going on. And to a certain extent, can continue to this day. I thought James Robinson and Leonard Kirk did a really phenomenal job. I will always have a deep and loving passion for Mark Waid and Mike Waringo's run. The John Byrne run, of course, is a seminal classic. So many good comics and so much good for the Marvel Universe came from the Fantastic Four. And I realize I have been actually kind of ranting. So TLDR, Fantastic Four is awesome.
I agree. Well, to go from one kind of mind-bending, mind-breaking book to another, we've talked about before, but Doom Patrol is my next one.
I'm surprised they're this low.
Well, we only got two in front of them.
Yeah, true.
But the next two will make perfect sense. But Doom Patrol being, once again, a book that can literally, you read that book, will just mess with your head. It is the equivalent of reading acid in a lot of ways.
Very true. That is absolutely true.
And it was weird because Morrison said multiple times before his drug days, so that's even crazier. Mm-hmm. But it is really, it is a book that you can have someone, and it is great at making you have your own new ideas because it really does play with not only the form of comics, but the form of what it is to think and what it is to exist, and plays that throughout that series, which are pretty, pretty heavy, heavy topics, and how it's handled is gorgeous, beautiful, and you can say anything from that book, and it shouldn't work. You shouldn't be able to say, like, oh, yeah, one of the main characters for a huge arc is a transvestite street.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You shouldn't say, oh, yeah, it's scissor people that cut out reality.
Right.
That sounds stupid and horrible, but it's amazing. And plus, if it wasn't for Doom Patrol, we wouldn't have what is possibly the greatest graphic novel, in my opinion, of all time, 4-issue series, Flex Metallo. So they go hand in hand for me. And Doom Patrol just, it's beautiful, it's gorgeous. It's one of those things where if you have never read Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol, pick it up. I'm sure you can find it somewhere. I know they released an omnibus not that long ago. The trades are kind of hard to find, but they're still somewhat in circulation.
Yeah, it took me a little bit of an effort to get all the Doom Patrol trades, but I managed to get them all collected, and I'm very, very happy with them. I just now formulated half a thought. I want to put it to you. I don't know if you will have any reaction to it, but I'm curious if you have any immediate reaction to this idea. The Doom Patrol is existentialism.
Yeah.
Well, that was easy.
No, yeah,
it's not that the characters are existential. It's not that the comic is trying to talk about existentialism as a concept. I'm saying that the comic itself is existentialism. No,
really. It combined with Invisibles and Filth and stuff like that. Like I said, they play with the idea of what it is to think more than anything else ever.
Well, I think Doom Patrol, Invisibles, and the Filth are a fascinating triptych.
Yes.
You know, they're a series of series that have absolutely nothing to do with each other except thematically, and those themes build on each other as Morrison comes to grips with the themes he's trying to deal with.
No, yeah, and it's so weird to say that too, because Doom Patrol is still such one of his early works in his bibliography. It's still so early, and yet from that early on stage, it was so there already.
Right. Well, he's one of those writers who very clearly is trying to grapple with ideas, and as early as Doom Patrol, he started working with them, and then dealt with them in the Invisibles, and then refined them in the Filth. And I think even, you know, if you want to take it even further, I think he is still working through them even as an older man with stuff like, even within the confines of the DC Universe and Multiversity.
Yeah, Multiversity and Nameless. We said it before when they came out. They feel like that same Morrison, just from an older standpoint, writing those same characters, basically.
Right, not just the same characters, but those same themes and concepts.
Same ideas.
It actually makes me very, very curious for the third volume of Sea Guy.
Yeah.
Because that's another one where he's really dealt with identity and thought and personality and what makes a person a person. And I'd love to see his most current take on those ideas, because Sea Guy and then Sea Guy, the Slaves of Mickey Eye were definitely written at a certain point in his life. And I want to see him return to that world with his older, not even more cynical view, but just his more adult take on those themes. So, yeah, to bring it back around, Doom Patrol, I think, was the flashpoint for him. You know, he'd done interesting things before. I mean, don't get me wrong, Animal Man is phenomenal.
Yeah.
But I think Doom Patrol was really the flashpoint where he started becoming the Grant Morrison that we know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because, I mean, like I said earlier, but Doom Patrol, going from Doom Patrol, and you could see the seeds of course, Flex Mentallo and a few other things there, but going straight into that and leading through Invisibles and leading through everything else, it is where he became, like, it's that moment. It is him stepping into the Batcave for the first time in a lot of ways.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, so there, Doom Patrol again, ladies and gentlemen.
My number one and my number two are both incredibly nostalgia-filled, so I don't know if I'll be able to argue these outside of the fact that they came, I found them at a very impressionable age, and I don't know if I can rationally argue their qualities, but I'm going to give it my best shot. And with that caveat in place, my number two is the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yep, I'm like you just said, surprised not number one, but I'm sure there's reason.
Right. There's something perfect about four hot-headed teenage brothers who fight with swords and are also turtles. There's something visually stunning about that. I remember, like I said, you know, I discovered the Turtles as a 7-year-old. I discovered them because of the combination of the toys and the animated series, which led me back to first the Archie comics and then back into the original Eastman and Laird black and white, more mature reader comics. But there's, even back in 1984, when that first book hit the stands, there's a reason the Turtles Empire became what it was. The first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles issue was supposed to be a one-shot. It was supposed to be a moneymaker so that Mirage Studios could actually do something with their lives. And the first printing sold out so quickly that they put it to second printing. And when that sold out, they realized they had something on their hands and started working on issue two. And a lot of that is, visually, the Ninja Turtles are fucking stunning.
Yeah.
They look awesome.
I mean, symbolic, if that's all that comes to mind. They are just, they are a perfect symbol.
Yes, exactly. And they're baller as hell. And then the story that developed around them, you know, the origins shamelessly ripped off from Daredevil, the idea of, you know, playing with ninjas and the combination of that and the 80s New York setting, making them brothers who acted like brothers, I think is actually a really important key to their characterization. Giving them all very distinct personalities to the point where you can have a admittedly terrible film like the 2014 Ninja Turtle movie that still manages to nail those personalities, and from that actually ends up being an entertaining film because those clear-cut, almost archetypal personalities are there from the beginning is astonishing and fantastic, and for me personally broke my brain in a way that I couldn't properly process as a child. So like I say, I don't think I can rationally argue, just from pure rationale and logic, that the Ninja Turtles are the second best superhero team, but for me personally, they mean so much, and there's so much there that I couldn't put them any lower than number two.
That's very fair, and a very beautiful sentiment there too.
Thanks, man.
Well, mine number two, and it's one I'm surprised is not on your list. Well, I don't think it is, at least. It's not a, we've mentioned a few times, they're not a traditional team, but they're a team that the book completely changed the way I think in a lot of ways. The Invisibles.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, you're right, they're not on my list. I went very traditional with my list without even trying, and I think it's because I'm older and I have a much more traditional fanboy grip on a lot of the stuff I love.
Well, that makes no boundaries for me. I don't care what came before if it's not. I do, but not enough to put them higher than this, because number two belongs to Invisibles. I said a book that completely changed the way I think. Halfway through, it came at a point in my life when I was already having thoughts that book was dealing with. Like you said, it's one of the books that are dealing with what it is to be alive, what it is to think, what it is to even exist, and it deals with so much so, and truly transcends what a comic book is to me,
right?
And transcends just, so it was number one for me, but it transcends more than just, and, you know, oh, this is a really good comic book. It's like, oh, this is a really good thought process almost. This is a really good way to deal with what you're thinking. And something, a book that just has so many, I know Morris would love it this way, but so many magical qualities to it.
Right.
Not only from the ways it was written to what Morrison did with the book and what the book may or may not have done to him. To, like we said, it's a book being all about sigil and stuff, and in itself being a sigil for wanting more artists to create. And somehow having weird world ramifications of having artists actually create stuff about and from the Invisibles.
Right.
And not only that, but being such an inspirational book that a lot of people don't realize it. I mean, a book that, as a lot of people would argue, may have been the biggest influence or biggest thing that the Matrix ripped off. And that the Wachowskis, you can constantly, they've talked about it before, the Wachowskis have talked about it being a huge influence on them and his work in general.
Right.
But it really, I think, ushered in a new era in a lot of ways. I mean, there were already a lot of books like that coming out, but it was also a book that people forget sold really well.
Yeah, no, it was a chart topper. And what's amazing, and a lot of people tend to forget this as well, he was writing Invisibles and JLA at the same goddamn time.
Yeah, and I don't know how you pull that off. Like,
right, exactly. And to the point where he was very clearly rushing a deadline, and there's an issue of the Invisibles and an issue of JLA that kind of line up.
Yeah.
Like, they're both working, they're both teams are... I don't remember the exact details, but they're basically trying to close an interdimensional portal. And if you were reading them that same month, it very much read like they're working in concert without knowing it to close this portal that could possibly cause the teams to cross over into each other's worlds.
There's a fan theory that, I mean, of course, it's just a fan theory, but that is weird that you bring an issue up. I was reading not that long ago. There's a fan theory that is what people believe inspired Morrison to want to write Seven Soldiers the way he did.
Right, I can believe that.
Which, for those who don't know, that's another one that I didn't think it put that on my list. Damn it.
Yeah, me neither. The team book that's not a team book because the teams all work, all the team members work towards a similar goal without ever meeting each other or even in some cases knowing each other's existences.
Yeah. God damn, that's a good, damn it.
It's such a good series. It's one of Morrison's best works, honestly.
That really may have been on my list. But besides that, Invisibles is just a book that I want to say it's not a book I recommend to everyone because I truly believe it's a book that you have to have an open way, an open mind in the way you think just to appreciate what is really going on in that book.
To sound super pretentious, I feel like Invisibles is a book you have to discover.
Yeah.
It's not a book you can have recommended to you. It's a book you need to hear from a friend who's really into it and be like, oh yeah, I really dig this. And then you'd be like, oh, I kind of want to try that. And they'd be like, sure, here you go. As opposed to someone coming up to you and being like, you should read this.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I can't even remember. I don't even remember exactly why I wanted to start reading Invisibles. I know I was into Morrison stuff, but some of the Invisibles I wanted to, and I bought a few issues. And then before I knew it, I bought that giant omnibus.
When I was in high school, my friend Keenan was super, super into the Invisibles, and that's how I discovered it was through him because it was a book that he was super into and super connecting with, and I wanted to see what the fuss was about, basically. I mean, Keenan is one of the smartest men I've ever met, and if the book was really, truly engaging him, I wanted to know what it was. What was this book that was so, you know, inspiring to someone like him? And that was my gateway into it. But it wasn't something he thrust on me. It was something that I asked about.
Yeah, I think, if I remember correctly, I know I bought the first trade after I had read a couple issues, and I bought the first trade from Awesome Books and Comics, and I bought the same day I bought Seven Soldiers.
Oh, wow. And that must have been nuts.
Very expensive for me at the time, too. but I remember really, really enjoying it, and it was around that time, you know, when they released the omnibus, so I bought that, and it's one of those books that, like, like I said, I don't even know why. I'll just pick up and revisit every now and then. Like, it doesn't have to make sense to me. I don't have to make it in any order. I can literally just pick up, read, and enjoy it. And it's the only book I can do that with that I can think of, really.
That's impressive, because I can't do that with the Invisibles. That's really impressive.
But, so Invisibles are number two.
All right. My number one, kind of, sort of, a good transition that I can pick out on one thing you said. The Invisibles came at you at just the right time. Mm-hmm. And number one came to me at exactly the time I needed it. You know, I was 11, 12 years old, just coming into puberty. You know, I'm sure TMI, but of course everybody does.
Yeah.
I was a nerdy, awkward kid. I didn't have a lot of friends. I had friends, but not a tremendous amount. I was an outcast. I was different. You know, comics were not what they are today. They were, you know, they were definitely the sign that you were weird, that you were, you know, not socially viable, that there was something wrong with you. And that was when I discovered the X-Men.
Ooh.
Yeah, so my number one is the book that I no longer identify with, but the book that I've never identified with stronger than in, you know, there's no other book I've ever identified with stronger than with those characters and with that team.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's plenty of arguments to be made about Claremont's defining run, Claremont's ability to mix drama and soap opera with action and metaphor. But for me, it comes down to I was a weird kid and I needed friends. And that's what the X-Men were.
Aww. Well, see, now yours was all beautiful and stuff. Mine may not be as beautiful now. We should end it with yours.
That's all right. This is our favorites list, man. So it makes no difference that
mine.
Yeah, I'm being weird right now.
Oh, dude, that's fine, man. I appreciate the emotion, real emotion. You know, Gil Lott, that it proves what comics can do for people.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah, the fact that I can still get emotional about that is it speaks to the power of the medium.
It does, and it means you're being honest about your number one.
That's true.
You don't do that over one you're not honest about. But no, it's beautiful. X-Men, I think for anybody, especially, like you said, at that time period, anyone who grew up reading comics, I mean, I hate to say it, I did not, but everybody in that time that all seemed to gather towards X-Men because they had hit a nerve in the social society that was going on at that time that a lot of people didn't realize, which was you had a lot of people that were kind of separated by geography or separated by no real way to interact with each other. But still had this love because it was a team that was dealing with similar problems, where a team of people that were completely shunned from society, even though they could do amazing things, they were shunned just because of what they looked like, what they did, what they could do, what people were afraid they would do.
Right. I kind of feel like I should put another bit of a caveat here. You know, I am a straight white male. I am super, super baseline when it comes to humanity itself. So I can't really come at it from a, you know, a homosexual angle. I can't come at it from a trans angle. I can't come at it from a race angle. But I did come at it from a, you know, everybody, especially at that age, feels lonely and awkward and weird.
Yeah.
And to have a book out there that you can latch onto from any angle is I think impressive and important.
Very much so. I mean, especially at that age. That's why we're here talking about comics, because there are comics that make us feel and we know what they can do. So when we see people that are abusing or not doing what they could be doing, that's why we get passionate, and why that's what people don't understand about so many of the angry nerds, quote unquote, if you will, out there, because a lot of them are just very passionate, just want other people to experience what they have. They just go about it in weird, wrong ways.
Right, exactly. I feel very, very lucky that I have been able to come into the social skills that I have. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there who never quite develop those. And unfortunately, they also tend to be quite loud and can color people's impression of our hobby as a whole. Mm-hmm. But I think for the most part, a lot of people out there are more like you and I. They're quiet, they're reserved, but they can talk, and they're very passionate about what they love.
Very true. Well, I can actually connect as well with this one. My number one should not come as any surprise to anybody ever, is Umbrella Academy.
Yeah.
and I think it has been the number one for probably the majority of the list we have done.
Yeah.
But for similar reasons, similar but different reasons, but it came, I think I started reading it when I was in high school, but of course, someone who was a huge fan of Gerard Way's work, a huge fan of My Chemical Romance, huge fan of all stuff, and I was kind of different, but a book that still touched me the same way, because I was someone that was friends with a lot of people. I did fit in really well, but also knew I was different than a lot of people, and that's Umbrella Academy touches on that very well so too, because you have these group of people that, you know, have a family and belong together, but amongst each other, they even feel kind of separated and feel kind of divided because of things that have happened in their lives and things that have happened since they were young. It deals a lot with growing apart and growing back together, and kind of a lot of the same things as X-Men does, but also where X-Men, they, because they felt so shunned, they never necessarily celebrated what they were a lot. Like, it was this big thing. Where Umbrella Academy were never necessarily afraid of who they were. They were just kind of, they knew that they were different.
Well, also, there's very much the difference between the family you choose and the family you're born into.
Yes.
And the X-Men were always much more comfortable with each other because they were the family they chose.
Exactly.
Whereas, as you just said, the Umbrella Academy were legit, you know, they were stepbrothers and sisters, they were stepbrothers and sisters, but they were family. They were,
grew up together,
to be together regardless. And there's definitely a different dynamic there.
Very much. And with the book that, it was a book that got me going, yeah, this is a medium for me. This is what I can do. If something like this could be this good, I, of course, have to be part of it.
Right.
And it's what made me, it was the first book that made me actually want it at all interested in making my own comic or making anything like that. And it's something that, again, it just, I think, goes, kind of like you said, when you connect with certain characters, certain authors, it was, came about a good time, came out from an author that I connected with his writing and the way that he handled a lot of things, and also just at a point in time that was crucial,
It is a perfect mix to breed something that you won't let go of.
Right.
And that's that was Umbrella Academy for me. It was something that's why I'm so that is a book I recommend to everybody and anybody, because I do feel like it's not as hard to get into, and it kind of, we talked about this on Umbrella Academy cast, but it kind of borrows so much from other stuff but remains its own identity, that you kind of get a taste of the X-Men, you get a taste of Doom Patrol, you get a taste of Invisibles and all this other stuff, but it's not enough to where you feel like you've read just something else. It's enough to where you go, I really like this, let me read other stuff like it. And it leads you down a rabbit hole, and you get to where I am today.
That's great. I love that, and I'm also really fascinated by the fact that this is probably, and not just because of what just happened, but this is probably our most emotional top 10 list, in that we have never talked, I don't feel like we've ever talked so passionately about our number ones as we just did with our number ones that we just listed.
No, I think so. I think team books, we both kind of gravitate toward team books, as a lot of people do. It goes back to the old adage of it was more bang for your buck if you got every hero in one comic.
Right, exactly.
And also just because the team books, like you said, especially when you're young and you either have friends that you're, whether it be are wanting friends, or you have friends that you just kind of, you have to be with. Either way, it's easier to relate to a team title where you can feel exactly what they're going through, because you know what they're going through. And when you get older, I think a lot of people gravitate towards more through the more introspective and more hardcore stuff, and even kind of revert back to just the fun of it.
Right, exactly. I think that's a really excellent way to put it.
Well, we originally were going to have a shorter one, but this one ran long for good reason.
Yeah.
But awesome.
Well, I am properly embarrassed, but I think it's
good. Never, I would never be embarrassed of true emotion. It's a bad thing to be embarrassed about.
True. I do hope everybody enjoyed the show today. Yes. I run out of intelligent things to say, and I apologize for that.
send us your favorite teams to us, and or videos of you selling what your favorite team are. Tell us who you like, or what comics affected you when you were young, old, or in between, or any age.
Yeah, absolutely. That's wonderful. We would love to hear from you, and any responses we get, we will read on air. The way to get a hold of us is you can hit us up on Twitter. You can hit us up at blah blah podcast. You can hit us up personally on Twitter. I am at Voodoo Ben.
I'm at HellhoundF5.
You can also hit us up on Facebook, facebook.com/blahblahpodcast, all one word. Or you can email us, blahblahpodcast@gmail.com. Again, all one word. So yes, please, we would love to hear you. Tell us we're wrong. Tell us you hate the Metal Men and that the Doom Patrol suck and that I'm wrong for crying about X-Men. Tell us who your favorite teams are. If you love Batman and the Outsiders beyond all reason, I cannot wait to hear why you think that's the case. We love reader feedback and reader mail. If you can, hit us up on iTunes and give us a rating there. It legitimately helps. It helps people find the show.
It'll help us a ton. And it allows us to know that you want more episodes like this. If not, we don't know what episodes to do. We just do what we want to do. But if you like more like this, we'll do more like this.
Yeah, so if you want us to keep fucking around, don't say anything. But if you actually have an idea of what you want to hear from us, let us know and we will give it to you.
Yes. And again, thank you guys for listening. And even if you don't like, subscribe, or whatever medium you're on, thank you for listening. It does mean a lot.
It does. We love each and every one of you. We don't know who you are, but your faceless images drift through our dreams every night, and we are happy.
Yes, except for Tim. There's someone else named Tim.
Yeah, fuck you, Tim.
Screw you, Tim. Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Except Tim.